The Ezra Squire Tipple Lectureship was established by a grant of the former President and Mrs. Tipple, after whom the lectureship is named, in the year 1928, as part of a campaign for seminary endowment. The lectures are supposed to be related to the biography of great Christian leaders, thinkers, or missionaries. A series of distinguished scholars have delivered these lectures since the year 1931. Among them we find names like G. Bromley Oxnam, Kenneth Latourette, Lynn Harold Hoff, Roland Bainton, Edwin Lewis. And this year the Tipple lectures are to be given by Dr. Denis Goulet, presently fellow of the Center for the Study of Development and Social Change in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Dr. Goulet received his education in a wide variety of institutions and countries. He studied at Providence College, Providence, Rhode Island, and St. Paul's College, Washington, D.C., where he received his Bachelor of Arts and his M.A. in Philosophy. After studies in Paris, France, he acquired his Ph.D. in Political Science from the University of Sao Paulo in Brazil, where he has spent a number of years. He has studied but also lived the lives of the underprivileged in France, Spain, Algeria, and South America, and he has lectured widely in the United States and Canada. Among a variety of articles and books that he has written, perhaps the best known is The Cruel Choice, which he wrote while working at the Center for the Study of Democratic Institutions in California in 1971. His theme for the Tipple Lectures this year is Christian Ethics and the Development Debate. And the title of the first lecture this evening is Churches, Prophets, and the Third World. As most of you know, tomorrow afternoon at 2 p.m., he will deliver a lecture on L.J. Lebret, the Pioneer of Development Ethics. On Wednesday evening at 8 o'clock, he will speak on Orlando Falsborda, Subversion as a Moral Category. And on Thursday morning, I'm looking forward to what you have to say.
Well, series of the four lectures to set the tone in the arena. The French writer Julian Benda was once asked by a journalist to define existentialism as a philosophy. He replied, "There is no such thing as existentialism. There are only existentialists." I am tempted to apply his provocative answer to the ethics of development, for clearly there is no pre-existing discipline bearing that name. There are, however, an increasing number of persons who make the value-laden ethical questions posed by economic development the central object of their study. During the present Tipple lectures, I shall examine certain biographies in the setting of an explicitly Christian reflection on development, hence my overall title, Christian Ethics and the Development Debate. It helps, I think, to explain at the outset these terms. By Christian ethics, I refer not to sectarian moral systems or even to a common corpus of disciplined moral thought, but to the ongoing reflection of Christians as they wrestle with ethical challenges posed by underdevelopment in the world. The development debate is precisely the argument around these challenges. It turns on conflicting views of the nature and proper goals of development, the requirements of social justice in a world of rich and poor, the effect of mass unemployment and dependency on the quest for a human life, and above all on redefining the good life in the modern setting characterized by enormous scale, technical complexity, multiple interdependencies, and a diminishing time lag between the impingement of stimuli to change on societies and the response to those same stimuli. A veritable host of ethical questions flows from the choices faced by development planners or technicians. How to plan change? What measures of coercion are tolerable? What principles should guide strategies? What is an optimum population? What degree of dependence on outside capital or culture is compatible with dignity and autonomy? The list could go on. When I speak of Christian ethics, I refer both to Christian individuals and to religious institutions. My focus is the positions churches take, especially in societies where their cultural influence has public, that is to say, political, impact. In Latin America, Africa, and Asia, churches in the past allied themselves for the most part to the status quo. And as they reflected on development, they relied on the expertise of others. On the world scene, churches identified with the interests of developed nations and with those of elite classes in underdeveloped countries. But now this stance is being vehemently contested. The development debate goes on ferociously within the very entrails of Christianity. It is a debate about praxis, not just theory, and it has historical scope. New prophets have arisen to do what prophets have always done, denounce what is in order to announce what ought to be. Let me now announce what you may expect from me in the next 4 days. My first topic is an overview of churches, prophets, and the Third World. Tomorrow I shall speak of a Frenchman, L.J. Lebret, the pioneer of development ethics. On Wednesday, I wish to reflect with you on the central message of a Colombian sociologist, Orlando Falsborda, subversion as a moral category. And the final lecture will end, as is fitting, with a question. Makers of history or witnesses to transcendence? And now on to our first lecture, Churches, Prophets, and the Third World. I wish here to review shifting church positions on development. I shall do so by outlining the stances of contemporary religious spokesmen and sketch the activities of Christian social prophets, political leaders, and scholars. This exercise will help identify the issues which are most salient for Christian participants in the development debate. Churches take their stand. Until a decade ago, most influential churches and religious organizations had aligned themselves with the status quo. This was the case of the Catholic Church in Latin America, of Christian missions in Asia and Africa, and of Christian denominations within the developed world. To describe precisely how Christian officials had come to this position lies beyond the scope of our present endeavors. Their posture, it is clear, derived from the secular evolutionary practice of adjusting to what ecclesiastical theorists rather quaintly called temporal power. Temporal power means simply political rulers. And Christianization efforts, by and large, have relied on those very rulers for logistical support. The cross did much more than follow the sword during the Spanish and Portuguese colonization of Latin America. It rode the same ships and receive the same royal subsidies as the sword. Less obtrusively, but no less intimately, Christian missionaries from the West proselytized in the traces of imperialist colonizers in India, Africa, and the Arab world. Rival factions usually won their entry into new mission fields according as one colonial power or another gained, ascendancy or economic foothold. Thus it was that Roman Catholics flourished in Indochina thanks to France's control there, whereas Protestants fared better in India. Protestants gained a late foothold in Catholic Latin America in the wake of the new American presence in the 20th century to challenge that of Catholic Spain, Portugal, England, and France. Not England, France. Church alliances with ruling groups in Third World nations correlate with the degree to which institutions of churches depended on native upper and middle classes for their financial support. These classes, of course, are precisely those with the greatest vested interest in existing social systems. Of equal significance is the ideological stance of the Vatican and worldwide Protestant bodies such as the World Council of Churches. Until recently, it was anathema to propose radical social reform, to challenge existing social authority, to criticize economic systems at their center and not at their periphery. Social enlightenment, however, came to the Protestant World Council of Churches at about the same time as John XXIII launched aggiornamento in the Roman Church. As long as conservatism ruled at the summit, therefore, it was to be expected that grassroots churches should likewise prove chary of brutal ruptures with the ruling system. But a new era has set in. The encyclicals Pacem in Terris and Populorum Progressio, the declarations of Medellin in Colombia, and the ecumenical meetings on development at Beirut, Montreal, and elsewhere have indeed created a new climate. Nowadays, it's become almost natural for churches to refute the conventional wisdom of the development establishment and to reconsider their own traditional posture towards ruling classes. Most church spokesmen, it is true, remain conservative and prudently moderate in their positions on social change. The same is true of mainstream church membership almost everywhere. Yet, dissident minorities are increasingly being heard. They are thrusting their own agendas into the debates of the majority in church assemblies. Class struggle, ideological conflict, competing politics, diverse party alliances, and religious strategies at every level are now the common experience of churches and religious organizations. These trends are not the product, however, of intellectual breakthroughs by theologians. On the contrary, new theological and pastoral orientations are themselves the expression of practical responses by Christian groups to the challenges posed to them by revolutionary movements, ideological militants, and guerrillas armed in struggle against repressive governments. Churches in the Third World have had no choice but to come to terms with the social forces shaping present history. As Helder Câmara, Catholic Archbishop of Recife in northeast Brazil, explains when speaking of the masses, quote, "It is easy to retort that their eyes will be opened with us or without us or against us. If this happened tomorrow and the masses of Latin America had the impression that Christianity was afraid, that it lacked the courage to speak out before the government and the propertied classes, they would reject Christianity because in their eyes it would clearly be an ally of their exploiters. The best way to combat Marxism is to teach a religion which is not the opium of the people, to preach a Christianity which, in union with Christ and following his example, embodies and appropriates all human problems in order to accomplish human redemption." End of quote. Denounced by their own members, who repudiate the ties of church to governing elites and privileged classes, theologians, bishops, ministers, and laypeople have been forced to redefine their stance towards temporal power, towards legitimate authority, towards the ethics of violence, towards the very foundations of Christian hope, towards the meaning of history, towards the gospel itself. I hope I am correct in assuming that this audience is already familiar with the efforts of major denominations to resituate themselves as regards what their mission is, especially in the Third World. The James Forman Manifesto, for instance, to the U.S. churches is no longer news. Neither is the creation of task forces to evaluate social and political effects of church investments in South Africa. Therefore, I shall not discuss here what is common knowledge. Instead, I wish to comment on the emergence into the public eye of new types of Christian personalities, prophets of development, political leaders whose view of development is directly linked to their faith, and development scholars whose Christian ethics informs their writings on development. Before doing so, however, let me briefly summarize the arenas wherein dissident Christians have staked out new positions in contrast to traditional ones. New groups favor liberation over law and order. They plead for broad participation of masses in change decisions, as opposed to elitist or top-down models of planning. They reject capitalism as radically immoral and structurally incompatible with social justice, even a capitalism which has been rectified or attenuated by welfare policies. They advocate socialism, therefore, however they define it. Among the values they highly cherish are national, regional, and local autonomy. This in opposition to dependency on outside influences. Self-determination is to be not only political, but economic, cultural, and psychological as well. Their goal is to achieve egalitarian patterns of social stratification, an option perceived by hierarchical churches as subversive of internal church order as well as of society at large. Theologians of development and of liberation express their choices by probing for new interpretations of history, of Christians' involvement in human tasks, and in the construction of secular values, together with groups representing the wishes of the people, even if these groups are openly hostile to religion or materialistic in philosophy. They are fond of John the 23rd's distinction between what he called error and those who commit error, even if we are dealing with men whose ideas are false or whose inadequate notions bear directly on religion and morality. This reference is generally interpreted to include communists and is meant as an approval from the Pope for Christians to cooperate with them in political and social matters. The commitment of militant Christians to liberation is not confined to rhetorical professions of principle or new conceptual models for the conduct of theology. It finds its expression in everyday life. Dominican priests in Brazil give sanctuary to urban guerrillas. Protestant missionaries in Uruguay actively support the Tupamaros. United States churches contribute funds to liberation movements in South Africa and Mozambique. Priests issue public ultimatums to their religious superiors, urging them to return church-owned lands to peasants in Bolivia or reject government subsidies in Peru for their schools. Such activists openly accept all political risks: suppression, jail, torture, exile, assassination. They aim to prove to the world, and especially to those who engaged in social militancy before they did, that they are serious about liberation and about the combat for development. In Chile, as in Tanzania, in Yugoslavia and Algeria, Christian churches are being summoned by some of their best members to help build socialism. If this new breed of Christians is labeled subversive for its troubles, it is learnt to glory in the label. Elder Commodus simply laughs when Pope Paul VI greets him at the Vatican as my communist archbishop. And Antonio Fragoso, bishop of Crateus in northeast Brazil, does not hesitate to write, "If those who fight for justice are called subversive, then subversion is their hope. Tomorrow they are going to struggle for justice. Will they be on the side of subversion? The game is being played wrong. The flag of freedom, the flag of justice at this moment, is being handed over into strange hands. The pattern is everywhere the same. Third world priests are denounced as communists by mainstream Christians in Argentina. Emilio Castro is viewed with ill-disguised suspicion by his cautious Protestant peers in Uruguay. Married old missioners Melville and Bompain are expelled from Guatemala. Daniel Berrigan is imprisoned and ostracized by most of his fellow Jesuits. A mildly reformist bishop in Spain or Portugal is deported or stripped of office. The historical stage has been set for the reappearance of a new brand of Christian social prophet." Two years ago, a course was launched at Indiana University on Hebrew prophets and black messiahs. Black American church figures Albert Clegg, James Boggs, Ron Karenga, and others were placed in tandem with classical Old Testament prophets Jeremiah, Amos, Ezekiel, Hosea. The common thread of prophecy is the charismatic personal vocation to denounce social injustice, to puncture the complacency of the powerful, to defend the interests of the weak and afflicted, and to summon co-religionists to return to the true God, the true morality, true righteousness. Christians committed to social change increasingly appeal to ancient prophetic exemplars. Protestant theologian Aaron van Leeuwen has argued that religion's major task today is to foster what he calls prophecy in a technocratic era. But theologians, preachers, and religious educators also look to the New Testament to find therein the more saliently prophetic passages. Latin American theologians of liberation are fond of such texts as Luke 4:18, "The Spirit of the Lord has been given to me, for he's anointed me, he's sent me to bring the good news to the poor, to proclaim liberty to captives and to blind new sight, to set the downtrodden free, to proclaim the Lord's year of favor." Or St. Paul, Galatians 5:13, "My brothers, you were called, as you know, to liberty." But not all prophets are preachers. On the contrary, David, Hosea, Jeremiah, and others prophesied more eloquently by their deeds than by their words. David ate the loaves of proposition. Hosea took an adulterous wife to mirror in his personal life Israel's infidelity to its God. And Jeremiah shattered a clay pot in the sight of the nation's leaders to symbolize that God would shatter their nation in equal fashion. Similarly, modern development prophets are better known sometimes for their actions than for their writings. This is true of Danilo Dolci, Camilo Torres, Sergio Mendez Arceo, James Groppi, Luther King, and others. But let me make a qualifying statement here to avoid misleading you. Not all prophets nowadays are social activists. Some are contemplative monks struggling to redefine the basis for a committed life of prayer, austerity, manual work, and solitude in terms of the racism, injustice, and exploitation prevalent in the very world they have fled. One thinks here of Merton, Thomas Merton, in his final years, of René Voyon, of Dan Berrigan himself, of dozens of monks and contemplative nuns in Taizé, or in the Defoucault fraternities throughout the Third World. Even cloistered monasteries are not the same under the assault of the development debate. Were there time enough, we could draw the portrait of innumerable Christian biographies of contemporary prophets. We cannot do so, even in the setting of this lecture. The exercise would surely be instructive. But a rapid overview might better convey the central truth that these figures are not rare exceptions, unrepresentative of a people at large. This is not so. Prophets, like theologians, are not makers of their age, but children thereof. They achieve prominence because throbbing human communities lie behind them. Prophets have always been the voice of those who have no voice. But they are heard only when the silent ones recognize these vicarious voices as their own. Danilo Dolci, often called the Gandhi figure, is the prophet of militant resistance to the special inertia bred of centuries of poverty and intimidation. He is no church-going man, but by his own declaration has nourished his mystical commitment to the poor in the Gospels. It is there he found the form of religion which accepts no alienation, no passive superstition which makes drought-ravished Sicilian peasants rely on prayers instead of on irrigation pumps. And Dolci will have nothing to do with God figures who serve as mystifying covers for a religiosity whose social expression is the fear of autocratic masters, be they feudal landowners or mafiosi. Dolci, himself a powerful father figure, approaches social change via an unlimited faith in the capacity of little people to overcome their fear and resignation, to evaluate their own problems critically, and to organize pressure on the powers above. On all these counts, he exemplifies major themes of the ethics of development now burgeoning in the praxis of revolutionary Christian communities. His testimony has double value precisely because it is not churchy Christian. It even has tinges of anti-clericalism, but it is not secular or anti-religious. Dolci respects the profound religiosity of his people and urges them to create a purified, historically liberating new expression of it. His whole life is prophecy. Another interesting prophet of development, likewise imbued with a deep Christian hope, is Brazilian educator Paulo Freire. Thank you. He is an eminently fit subject for a full-length profile on Christian biography. I mention him because he's the prophet of conscientization, that radically critical conscience and consciousness of the incarnational Christ of history. Freire labors incessantly to de-alienate transcendence. His central vision of all human beings as subjects and not objects of history subverts any pallid exegesis of Christian redemption. His almost supernatural hope in the ability of exploited, domesticated, annihilated victims of the culture of silence to free themselves is the political reflection of his acceptance of a divine Christ who truly divinizes man. No social critic, no political activist, more than Freire, gives such forceful expression to St. Paul's assertion that God has chosen the poor of this world to confound the rich, the foolish to bring down the wise. Freire serves as the living prophet of this Christian belief by his pedagogy of the oppressed, his strategy for liberation, his politics of historical transformation based on the oppressed themselves, on their ability to assume mastery over their own destiny, even when they accept allies from the ranks of the oppressors. These allies defect from their own class interests and provide documents, information, access to people, funds, and logistics support to those who must eventually free themselves. The totality of Freire's liberating cultural action bears witness to his belief, thoroughly Christian in its dialectical relationship to freely proffered divine grace, in the radical freedom of the human will, even when it has been enslaved for centuries. Few Christian prophets of development, however, are so eye-catching as Camilo Torres, son of a respected Colombian bourgeois family, youthful playboy turned priest, trained sociologist, university professor, campus minister, reformist politician, and finally, guerrilla fighter. Torres' justification for joining the National Liberation Army goes to the very heart of our question. In a declaration to the press on June 25, 1965, following his request to the Archbishop of Bogota for permission to return to the lay condition, Camilo Torres argues that his priestly love of the people, especially the poor, is what leads him to revolutionary struggle. This activity is, he says, essential for my life as a Christian and as a priest and as a Colombian. Camilo Torres chooses the Christ of the oppressed, the violence of the gospel. I have come to set son against father, brother against brother, etc., the church of the poor. Reviled in life, revered in death, Camilo went the way of most revolutionaries. But his dramatic options have brought a new variable into the ethical debate on violence. It is no longer possible for Christian moralists to condemn violence out of hand. So compellingly has Torres embraced violence out of a specifically Christian commitment to justice and love of the poor that anything less than existential arguments appear flimsy indeed. Camilo Torres sacrificed much when he resigned his priestly functions. But, as he put it, how could he celebrate the Eucharistic memorial, the communion, until he had first fought to make communion among men a social possibility? He once wrote, "I am sacrificing one of the rites which I love most deeply, that of celebrating the external communion of the church as a priest, in order to create the conditions which would render this cult more authentic." Was not any other form of worship hypocritical? Shades of Old Testament times when the prophet could say, "Not incense or burnt offerings, but justice and pity are what are pleasing in the sight of the Lord." Camilo Torres is a Latin American Christian honored by Fidel Castro, who dedicated a school in Cuba named after the Colombian priest. Torres has had imitators among his fellow priests, Domingos Lain in Colombia, and a few others whose names must remain secret. But his influence reaches far beyond his imitators. A whole generation of Latin American ministers and priests now measures the seriousness of its commitment to social justice against Torres as a paradigm. Earlier I mentioned El de Cámara. He too is a typical Christian prophet of development in the Latin American mode. There is no need to summarize his achievements or repeat his message here, for Helder has become a world symbol. He is the fragile David who slings outrages at a new Goliath, the Brazilian military regime. Helder is the voice of the silent ones in his own land, the conscience pricker of Christians in the rich world, and the galvanizer of dormant energies in the third world. For many years, Cámara dreamed of mounting a massive, nonviolent campaign of resistance to the structural violence of misery, unemployment, and illiteracy throughout Latin America. He argued that the reactionary ruling classes in Latin America, relying on the military, diplomatic, and economic might of the United States, could easily crush any violent revolutionary movement once it was recognized by the stewards of the status quo as threatening. Hence, he concluded that it was not only fidelity to the gospel, but hard-headed realistic tactics as well to organize nonviolent resistance. His dream never became reality. Luther King was killed before he could accept Cámara's invitation to visit Recife. Worse still, even the mild protest actions organized by Helder in his own land were stifled. His name may not be spoken in the Brazilian press except to defame him or to report some trivial churchy news of no consequence. Though silenced at home, Cámara's voice has boomed out elsewhere in the third world. And in Europe and the United States, he has become a prophetic gadfly, calling upon students and development professionals to revolutionize their own society if they would truly help the third world. And reminding them that the struggle for justice in society must come before brilliant professional careers. Above all, Cámara has refuted the argument of those who would twist his nonviolent creed into a condemnation, however tacit, of the path chosen by Camilo Torres. As Elder Cámara himself wrote, "I respect those who feel obliged in conscience to opt for violence, not the all-too-easy violence of armchair guerrilleros, but those who have proved their sincerity by the sacrifice of their life. In my opinion, the memory of Camilo Torres and of Che Guevara merits as much respect as that of Martin Luther King. I accuse the real authors of violence, all those who, whether on the right or the left, weaken justice and prevent peace. My personal vocation is that of a pilgrim of peace. Personally, I would prefer 1,000 times to be killed than to kill." I shall stop here since I despair of being exhaustive, but a roll call of Christian development prophets would include other names: Camilo Moncada, Gustavo Gutierrez, Emilio Castro, Ruben Alves, and countless others in Africa. I ignore the names of these Africans simply because my own attention has long been riveted almost hypnotically on the fascinating Latin American continent. Cynical or skeptical professionals of development might argue that the religious figures I have evoked are marginal types, or that their influence on development struggles is minor. I believe they are mistaken. But even if we were to accept their premise for the sake of argument, they could not so easily dismiss the impact of two other kinds of Christian figures who are deeply engaged in forging a vital ethics of development. I refer to politicians and development scholars. A word on politicians. The mandate I have received to relate the ethics of development to Christian biography would carry me too far. If I were let loose, I would want to do justice to the special contributions made to development thinking and practice by Julius Nyerere, by Leopold Senghor, by Tom Maboya, by Eduardo Frey, by André Philippe, by Jacques Chonchol. We would learn much, I am sure, by comparing such politicians with old-time political leaders whose Christianity was purely ornamental or instrumental. Politicians of the old school did not take Christianity seriously. They merely put it to use as Bonaparte, Mussolini, or Franco put it to use. What is striking about the newer leaders, however, is the degree to which their personal Christianity colors their very notion of the exercise of political power and of the content to be given to their development program. I am not implying that Nyerere and Senghor have the same model. Of course not, although both speak of creating an indigenous African socialism. More striking still is the difference between the two Chilean politicians, Frei and Chonchol. Frei is the basically conservative Christian Democrat, reformist president, whose political acts prove to be far more timid than his bold rhetoric, itself hedged with a prudent array of technical qualifications. But his former colleague, Chonchol, broke with Frei and now works with Allende after undergoing an important ideological revolution. What is common to all these politicians is the manner in which each thought it necessary to determine what his politics ought to be in terms of his Christian theology. Their cases are so revealing because they are so unusually honest. Most politicians, it is true, cling in the recesses of their instincts to a theology of sorts, but they usually overlay this theology with the verbal trappings of Machiavellianism, of Hobbesianism, of Leninism, of pragmatism, of whateverism. This is why I deem it worth at least a moment's pause for us to reflect on the development ethics of politicians. I will confine myself to brief remarks on Nyerere and Chonchol. Nyerere's themes are well known: self-reliance in education, appealing to African tribal values as the motor of development energies, the option to accept slower economic growth so as to involve the whole populace in whatever growth is achieved, a stubborn refusal to submit to the leverage, however subtle, of aid givers, even at the cost of losing grants and loans, the need to dynamize the countryside rather than to allow urban concentration to command economic decisions and allocate professional services. These are not insignificant themes, nor are Tanzania's policy choices to be viewed as negligible in the larger puzzle of development strategies. But for our own purposes here, I prefer to call attention to other contributions Nyerere has made to the development debate. These contributions are traceable, in my opinion, to his loyal attachment to fundamental, though not fundamentalist, Christian ethical postulates. The first trait, I hope you'll excuse me, I've had a sore throat in the past, so I'm going to need a lot of water. Keep myself lubricated. Thank you. Wait, let's just keep it up here on the top. That's fine. Thanks. The first trait in Nyerere's political style which commands our attention is his remarkable sense of detachment from pre-existing development models. The Tanzanian president seems to have been immunized against the blandishments of capitalism as well as the seductions of communism with equal success. Hence, his unswerving insistence on the need to create one's own model. It is as though he understood that just as religious conversion can only come from inside a person, so too, in parallel terms, a nation's choice of a development path must be self-generated. There is no doubt about Tanzania's basic commitment to socialism. This is clear, explicit, and irrevocable. But socialism is not something that others decree or export. It is what Tanzanians themselves must build if they are to be genuine. That is, the architects of social justice for all within structures of freedom from alienation. As Nyerere once wrote, quote, "Tanzania is not now a socialist country. It is only a country whose people have firmly committed themselves to begin building socialism. The actual work has barely begun, for socialism is not built by government decisions, nor by acts of parliament. A country does not become socialist by nationalizations or grand designs on paper. It is more difficult than that to build socialism. It takes much longer." Nyerere later explains that socialism for Tanzanians is expressed by the Swahili word ujamaa, meaning familyhood or togetherness. The policies of other countries are referred to as kisocialisti, socialist. But, adds Nyerere, quote, "by the use of the word ujamaa, we state that for us socialism involves building on the foundation of our past and building also to our design. We are not importing a foreign ideology into Tanzania and trying to smother our distinct social patterns with it. We have deliberately decided to grow as a society out of our own roots, but in a particular direction and towards a particular kind of objective. We are doing this by emphasizing certain characteristics of our traditional organization and extending them so that they can embrace the possibilities of modern technology and enable us to meet the challenge of life in the 20th century world." Just as Nyerere views Christianity as embodying certain universal human values, notwithstanding its historical development in a particular cultural setting, so too he argues that socialism is a universally valid term which captures the human aspiration after justice, dignity, and togetherhood. Were we able to analyze in detail the Christian roots of Nyerere's concept of austerity and simple living, his position on the relative merits of violence, on the need for secularism in a modern state, one would find, I suspect, similar close correlations. His stubborn insistence on human dignity as the primary value is a repudiation of any ideology or political philosophy which would absolutize either politics or society itself. His stress on austerity, not primarily as a necessary evil in the early phases of capital accumulation, but as a permanent component of authentic development, has deep Christian roots. It is true that Mao Zedong, during the Cultural Revolution, made the same argument. But if we are to believe missionaries who knew him as a young man, Nyerere reflected long on the liberating message of Christian of gospel poverty. Julius Nyerere, in short, stands as a striking example of a Christian whose political stance takes its peculiar expressions in function of his ethics of development. He is critically attentive to the special forms of alienation proper to socialism, not just to those attendant upon capitalism. Although he grants the need for a strong state and a high degree of central power, Nyerere never idolatrizes or absolutizes that power. States, governments, must serve the people, and power must create justice. As he reflects on the monumental and irreparable costs which often accompany social violence, Nyerere steers between the Scylla of complicity with structured violence under the banner of law and order and the Charybdis of uncritical glorification of violence to achieve revolutionary purposes. The long march, and this is the very term he uses, of Tanzania, he says, must be an economic one. Although its people are deeply religious, the national task, and therefore the national state, must be secular. Otherwise, it would be provincial, intolerant, and out of tune with the real forces of history. Nyerere is at once a very wise man and a shrewd politician. Christians ought to derive at least some small measure of satisfaction in discovering that the two qualities can coexist within the same person. They need to believe this, of course, even in the face of most conventional secular wisdom, which denies the very possibility. Jack Chonchol is the Minister of Agriculture in the Allende government. Shortly after the election of Eduardo Frei to the presidency of Chile in 1964, Chonchol, at Frei's request, returned to Chile to work in the government. This seemed a logical and a natural thing to do, since Chonchol was himself a Christian Democrat and an experienced agronomist and economist. He had just spent 7 years working in Cuba under the auspices of the Food and Agriculture Organization, under Batista and under Fidel Castro. Eduardo Frei invited him to help lay the theoretical and programmatic groundwork for land reform in Chile. Chonchol has authored several works on development, land reform, and a Latin American way of development which would be neither capitalistic nor communistic. Given his combination of scholarly inclinations and his zest for field work, Chonchol is a very interesting political figure to study. He has simultaneously three vocations. He is at once a skilled technician in land reform, a field of vital importance for development, a Christian social philosopher, and a practicing politician. There is no evidence that any radical changes have occurred in the agronomist-economist side of his personality, although his duties in recent years must surely have enriched his store of professional knowledge. I am particularly interested, however, in the main lines of his evolution as a Christian social philosopher and practicing politician. This interest is dictated by the knowledge that the Chonchol of 10 or 15 years ago has evolved into a public person who puts flesh and programmatic concreteness on the new ethics of development and theologies of liberation we have been discussing so far. Because he has changed so drastically, while not renouncing the basic principles of his earlier phase, Chonchol is an exceedingly interesting case study. During the first 2 years of the Frei presidency, 64 to 66, Chonchol was a true believer in the merits of a third way of development, neither capitalism nor socialism. But the model failed. It lacked roots in real contending social forces. Frei was sometimes bold in rhetoric, as was John Kennedy in his early Alliance for Progress speeches, but timid in execution. His hesitations, however, are not traceable to personal defects or to a failure of nerve. The causes are structural. Frei had won his mandate because enough people who wanted far-reaching change in Chile thought they could get it from him, while at the same time enough conservative voters who feared the worst, that is to say socialism and Allende, thought that it was safer to accept partial change under Frei, who was quite solidly committed to parliamentary democracy and free enterprise, than to risk losing everything should a more radical candidate win. Hence, Frei's apparently noble experiment failed because underneath the appearances, it was essentially a program of palliatives. Furthermore, he could not bring himself to overstep the ideological limits of his own Christian Democrat model of development. Chonchol, on the other hand, quickly discovered that the model could not work. He swallowed his past ideological preferences and moved creatively via a series of quantum leaps, politically speaking, to a new position. Thus, midway through the Frei regime, Chonchol left his position as director of research in land reform and withdrew from the Christian Democrat Party. Later, he campaigned actively for Allende under the banner of MAPU, a small new party with a commitment to Christian socialism. Chonchol's subsequent departure after his appointment as agriculture minister by Allende from MAPU to help form the Christian Left Party does not hold any major ideological significance. The move has been explained by Chonchol himself and by his close friends in several parties as merely a practical device to mobilize neglected floating segments of a potentially socialist electorate in support of Allende. What is most important throughout this evolution, however, is Chonchol's repudiation of the Third Way model and his unqualified acceptance of socialism as a valid form of humanism. So much for his political stance in the practice of his profession. As a Christian social philosopher, he proved more dialectical than either Frey or Roger Weckmann's, Frey's leading intellectual mentor. Less fearful of history's risks, willing to run whatever risk may befall a Christian who cooperates with communists, Chonchol turned full circle and is now fully integrated, ideologically speaking, into the Christians for Socialism school. There is no time here to narrate the remarkable odyssey of the Christians for Socialism in Chile, nor to summarize the political philosophy of their most eloquent spokesman, Gonzalo Arroyo. These have been ably documented in the form of an exegesis of the Chilean hierarchy's pastoral letter on the gospel, politics, and socialism. But to this day, Chonchol continues to be a practicing politician, a Christian social philosopher, and a development technician engaged in land reform. The major feather in his cap, unless one considers mere survival in the ministry to be that kind of feather, is the implementation of a land reform, a radical land reform throughout Chile, in 18 months on the basis of legislation he had himself passed under Frey. It is sometimes said that Eduardo Frey made Salvador Allende possible. There is some truth in this, surely. Frey's failures in 1964 to 70 doubtless made Allende's victory possible. But this is only half the story, since Allende's candidacy in 1964 is also what made Frey possible in that year. What is more germane to our own discussion of Christian ethics in development is that the Chonchol of the Frey years made the Chonchol of the Allende years possible. There is hope here, living proof that Christian developmentalists need not be trapped in their own ideological heritage. Without betrayal, but also without cowardice, they can move dialectically to positions which bring reality to the dreams of liberation theologians. Whatever may be Chonchol's future as a politician, and his position is admittedly fragile, his evolution in these years remains a remarkable example. Final word on development scholars. I shall be even more concise in my treatment of the special input made to the development debate by Christian scholars than I have been in my treatment of prophets and politicians of social change. The reason is not simply the time constraint. Rather, it is that most development scholarship by Christian writers, professors, advisors, and practitioners has used its Christian ethical gestalt rather sparingly when writing of development. One may read, of course, such works as Gabriel Bowe's The Third Horseman, but the synthesis that this book attempts between economics and ethics is not very convincing. Much writing on development by identifiable Christian writers is not rigorous and falls easily into preachy moralism. This is true of papal encyclicals as well, or reports of religious conferences on development themes. Nevertheless, we ought to give the churches their due. The educational materials they prepare for their own constituencies have improved noticeably in quality in the last 5 years. And church writers on such issues as foreign aid, world trade, and corporate investment in the third world sometimes attain high levels of documentation and sound scholarship. By and large, however, those Christian writers on development, whose professional credentials are unimpeachable, have not labored ex professo to inform their work, that is, to breathe life and form into it by a critical recasting of their Christian ethics of development. Less systematically, nonetheless, several important development professional scholars have brought profoundly Christian categories into the development debate. One clear example is Barbara Ward, the British economist. A pervasive concern for social justice and the need to create conditions fostering human dignity characterize her work. But it is when she emphasizes the world community, the solidarity of all humans in spaceship Earth, and the need for cooperation among all dwellers in the global village, that Barbara Ward evokes for us, without, however, using the term, the mystical body of the Christian religion. One may reject Ward's consensus model and her reluctance to accept conflict and social mutations as necessary and at times humanly good. But there is no denying her fervent universalism and her patient insistence on the need to forge new bonds of solidarity. Lady Jackson, as she is known, has also advised several ecumenical Christian task forces to create guidelines for church involvement in development. So have Jan Tinbergen, Robert Bowie, Robert Theobald, and a bevy of others. I have just mentioned Tinbergen, the Dutch economist and planning theorist. He was the first economist to receive the Nobel Prize. His work in economic planning mirrors the lifetime dedication of a man who is passionately committed to excellence and to the service of the entire human race. Tinbergen, a longtime socialist in his native Netherlands, attaches special importance to worldwide planning. His concern is clearly consonant with the best universalist streak in Christian culture. At its best, this culture is a forceful corrective to ethnocentrism and narrow parochialism. Other names of development scholars could also come to mind, names such as the French economist François Perroux, Destin de Bernice, Jacques Austry, Jean-Marie Albertini. Their writings contain flashes of the Christian social conscience and of the universalism I have evoked in speaking of Barbara Ward and Jan Tinbergen. Equally prominent is the acute sense these authors have of the relativity of purely economic or technical solutions to human problems. Austry, particularly in his work Islam in the Face of Economic Development, draws our attention to the manner in which homo religiosus behaves in response to economic stimuli. And although Peru repeatedly disavows speaking as a moralist and argues that he is merely analyzing reality as it truly is in its existential complexity, he comes closest to being a development economist whose thought is informed by overtly Christian ethics. In development circles, the name of Peru is usually associated with the strategy of development poles. Moreover, his theory of development as a dynamic threefold process of creation, signification, and propagation has proved seminal for many a student of development. But in many of his works, Peru conveys his faith in a quasi-prophetic technological universalism which no critical reader can bring himself to divorce from the author's tenacious Christian roots. A growing number of Christian scholars now make of development their central topic of study. One thinks here of sociologists, the Belgian sociologist François Houtard, of the Egyptian philosopher René Abbachi, of theologians like the Brazilian Ruben Alves or the Peruvian Gustavo Gutierrez, the American Richard Shaw, or even the Dutchman Van Leeuwen. But the crucial question, it seems to me, comes from the lips not of Christian students of development, but of development experts. They may ask, are these studies significant? Is their input one that development professionals ought to take seriously? Perhaps I can best answer by narrating an episode. At an informal seminar I attended several years ago, Van Leeuwen kept talking about development in rigorously theological terms. Several economists, political scientists, and educational planners who were present expressed great skepticism regarding Van Leeuwen's credentials to speak on this subject. But when he proceeded in an informal evening session to tell of his experience over 25 years as a missionary in Indonesia, they were silenced by his overwhelming knowledgeability and impressed with his political acumen. The interesting upshot is that one of the economists present, who is now director of the Latin American Studies at a large American state university, drafted a paper on the relevance of religious thought to development economics. He, at least, had clearly learned his lesson and has not ceased since then to cross-fertilize himself with theological and ethical sources he had previously chosen to ignore. Most development specialists, of course, continue to remain indifferent to philosophical and theological studies on development and social change. This is lamentable, since both disciplines are deeply value-oriented and normative. Moreover, both philosophy and theology are ambitious architectonic disciplines which place great value on synthesis. The values approach and the search for synthesis are precisely what have been lacking in development studies, as Myrdal has affirmed in Asian Drama and other works. This is why I do not hesitate to express the hope that economists, political scientists, anthropologists, cross-cultural sociologists, planners, geographers, administrators, and financiers may soon begin to look more seriously towards philosophy and theology for new inputs in their reflection on development. And it does seem as though some breakthroughs are beginning to be made in development thinking by theologians, historians, and comparative religionists. One suspects that independent Christian scholars, once they have loosed themselves from their traditional moorings, are freer than their secular peers in the social sciences to explore totally new perspectives and formulate novel interpretative schemes. I now come to my final concluding remark. Christian ethics and Christian institutions have been challenged by the social forces which have thrust the third world into the trajectory of history. Consequently, the development debate has become central to critical reflection on Christian ethics. The burning questions have now been clearly detected. Is social justice possible in a world of unequal wealth? Should all people share in decisions, or must development choices be left in the hands of a technocratic and managerial elite trained to search for optimum efficiency and productivity? What moral standards should be used to decide how much and what kind of violence is necessary to achieve desired change? How does one measure a tolerable, as against an intolerable, human cost of development policies? And what are the true dimensions of liberation and authentic development? One finds a seriousness and a dramatic intensity in Christian ethical reflection in the third world today, which heretofore has been lacking. Interlocutors know that the stakes are high. The quest for human development becomes increasingly coextensive with the struggle for liberation. But theologians and Christian ethicists engaged in the development, as much as anybody else, want to be on the winning side. The trouble is, no one knows which is the winning side, and no one knows how to identify it. If the Christian reflective experience seems ambiguous, it is no more ambiguous than development itself, an ambiguous adventure par excellence. I, for one, do not know whether Christian ethics
much
of the economic growth or technical modernization that has come in the past has only benefited a small percentage of our population, and it's precisely these privileged classes that are in active alliance with the dependency that our nations or our societies as a whole, you see, suffer from vis-a-vis the Western world or others. So that these things, of course, are still in a state of flux, the exact content and the exact emphasis. But by and large, at least in the Latin American context, as it comes from theologians, there is an attempt to resurrect the Old Testament and New Testament themes of justice and human liberation, you see, and a kind of freeing man to be fully what his potential should summon him to be, and that consequently the mass consumer society, for instance, is largely condemned as being very alienating. Capitalism is viewed as being structurally immoral for the reason that it gives primacy as its motor mechanism of generating energies and activities, the search for profit, and that means that this is a motor mechanism which responds primarily to effective purchasing power. And when you're starting in a society where there's a small number of very privileged with a lot of wealth and a large number of people who don't have even the necessary things, to have an economic system based on the principle of providing what the effective purchasing power wants means is that you're designing something that will satisfy the wants of those who already have, but not the needs of those who have least. So they see that as structurally unjust, you see, inequitable. So that their vision is really an attempt to see, well, what would be the total development of the whole society? Yes, it would be the abolition of mass poverty and mass illiteracy and mass poor housing, you know, and mass unemployment and everything, but it would not be the abolition of this in a way that doesn't make of human beings, what Paulo Freire says, the active subjects of their own destiny, the active agents or creators of their own change. And sometimes they quote a statement made by an African president, Senghor, many years ago when he was speaking in the cultural context, we Africans do not wish to be mere consumers of civilization. So the emphasis here is very much on the Promethean streak, you see, that human individuals have a right not to be thrust into social situations that impose determinisms on them, even if these determinisms were to be kind of a bread and circuses kind of civilization. So these are the major themes that are constantly emerging. And of course, over the years, with the feedback from the criticism and, you know, and the practical forging of refinements, they're gradually taking their place into, in a sense, kind of a new approach to thinking about development. Well, just a final word, one of the very recent and one of the kind of more systematically thought out presentations of this approach to development is now available in English. It will be published next month as a book on the theology of liberation by Gustavo Gutierrez, the Peruvian. It'll be out next month as a full-length book. Now, this will be one of the first really solid pieces of work in English. There have been many short articles or documents. But generally, we've just gotten fragments of that. And of course, in certain situations, let's say like Colombia or Venezuela, they have had to argue in a whole new way. You know, well, what is the class struggle? We'll be talking in one of the later lectures, I'll go into some depth about, you know, a Christian, new Christian reflection on class struggle or on the ethics of revolutionary violence. You see, a whole number of very practical kinds of options they've been faced with. So this is not sort of some spinning off of new theological theories or social philosophy off in the air somewhere. It's been a practical response of church groups in the face of existing challenges. You know, usually deeply embedded in their own society with conflict and competing groups. Yes, sir.
Straightforward sense in which the common streak of prophets are people who feel that their loyalty to God's mandate to them, you know, in their own society is to separate themselves from a comfortable association with the powers or the wealthy and denounce the structural injustice and to take the cause of the poor and the widows and the oppressed, and basically to denounce the injustices all around them, but with a view to announcing new possibilities which would help their own people return to true righteousness, true religion, true brotherhood. So I think that it's quite legitimate to interpret, you know, especially a certain number of people who really understand, or at least express their preaching and their life as an attempt to incarnate their history, their Christianity in the present history they're living in, you see? Now, one could quarrel and say, well, that's not a justified use, but I think that if one tries to understand the profound dynamics as to why they're doing this, what are the basic values they are loyal to, you know, what they are appealing to. They're not appealing basically to a revolutionary philosophy. They're not appealing basically, let's say, to a new model of social, social philosophy or something like that. They're basically saying, well, what does the gospel require of us? In our set, characterized, let's say, by a small group of wealthy, privileged people, and large numbers of masses. I mean, what does it mean to incarnate our ethical responsibility to work for greater justice?
You have mentioned about the Tanzanian presidents declaration. I have heard of in the newspaper that he made a declaration. What does it actually mean? A development which is detached from redevelopment. You have mentioned these terms here.
Which is?
A development which is detached from the pre-development.
From the?
The previous development.
Oh, the models, huh?
No, relative detachment. You have mentioned that this president made an attempt for a development which is detached from the previous development. What is exactly?
Well, I think you're referring to two things that overlap. One, is Nairi emphasizes very much, very strongly, the need of any people, and in his case it's his Tanzanian people, the different tribes that compose the Tanzania. So he is aware of, you know, certain differences and local and regional differences, but he says, we do not want to look to the United States as the model for what our development in Tanzania ought to be. So he's detached from a pre-existing model. At the same time, says we don't want to look to the Soviet Union and say they're the ones that have the model. That's why he stresses the different words, say Ujamaa, which is a Swahili African word that has deep roots in their communitarian and tribal past, as distinct from Kisocialismo, which is the Swahili equivalent of socialist to designate, let's say, a country like the Soviet Union, or Yugoslavia, or whatever, say, or Cuba. So he says, when I speak of socialism, I don't understand, let's say, a model that was existing somewhere else. By socialism, I mean placing in the forefront, a primary obligation of all of the citizens to the welfare of society, and not their own private betterment or their private acquisition. So on the one hand, there is a desire to be relatively indifferent or detached from imported models or recipes or policies, whether it's from the capitalist or the socialist side. On the other hand, it's a wish to incarnate and to link the efforts at defining their own policy and their, you know, their own social model in terms of pre-existing African values. And that's why they have these so-called Ujamaa villages. Now, everybody recognizes that it's a difficult task. They've not succeeded perfectly, that there's a genuine commitment on the part of Nairi, and he even, you know, cut the salaries of all of the major, when he talks about austerity, that it wasn't just a lot of words or rhetoric, that he cut the salaries of all of the top government officials by half and started by cutting his own and living in a modest little house, you see. And then when he says that it's very dangerous to allow ourselves to get infatuated by the mass consumer goods, because once we allow to get ourselves infatuated by the mass consumer goods in the Western world, this necessarily leads to a model of development which concentrates very heavily in the urban centers and depends on foreign capital and may leave large segments of the population isolated from the progress. So he says it's better to make less economic progress, but make that progress, which is shared by the whole population, or as much of the population as possible, you know, and with greater emphasis on working for the country because it will improve everybody rather than just to gain your own inquisitiveness. So at least in the, you know, the general plan and its intention, he has understood very clearly how alienating it would be to pursue one way. But here again, I'm not trying to romanticize him, I'm not trying to argue that he succeeded perfectly. He is not. And there are some pressures on him, you know, from inside and outside, but on these kinds of compromises. But I hope that that helps clear up some of it.
So earlier the word the model was not used. Now I'm clear, thank you.
Yeah. Here is another question.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, I gather that it's still enough out in Asia and Africa, the wood development still has good connotations, but I gather that Latin America has become a dirty wood.
Almost, yeah.
Because of its association with things like the Alliance for Progress and the Peace Corps and a few other things. Would you like to comment?
Yeah, very briefly. I think you're largely correct in you know, kind of telescoped way, but with some important qualifications. For instance, if you go to Chile now, even though they are trying to build a socialist government and socialist society, trying, and they're not moving too fast, because they recognize the realities that the country is largely split, and even in Chile, though, and in Cuba, in their documents and in their public speeches, people will talk about desarrollo, económico and social and educacional. So they will speak of development. So there is a kind of schizophrenia about the use of language. Even these theologians of liberation in Colombia or Argentina or Uruguay or Venezuela or Peru, even though they will speak disparagingly of desarrollismo, developmentalism, as being a kind of, as you put it, almost a dirty word, it's sort of the domesticated version of development. As long as you sort of abide by Uncle Sam's ground rules, you know, you can get some of the goodies. There is an element of that. Nevertheless, there is an element of politics in this and rhetoric. I mean, you get the denunciation of the word and the things that it is stood for, much more for outside consumption, whereas you get for inside consumption, you get to see in their newspapers and official journals, you know, a lot more speaking of, well, we have to do more for the development of the poor, you know, the housing development of the poorer workers in our cities, and the agricultural development so we can bring up and modernize our agriculture. So I think one mustn't take too absolutely just the strict literal semantical use of this. I mean, it's largely an effort to repudiate the kind of domination dependency relationships that have characterized even the discussions about development, most of which have originated, you know, in the non-developed countries and in circles of economists and financiers and administrators of aid. So I think if you view it as a kind of double game, you know, or a dialectic game, that you can come closer to appreciating how it's being used and what's the meaning.
I'm dealing with your idea of development of what later on, or would you like to comment on that?
Well, I think I'd rather hold that off. I mean, I've written a lot about that in different places, and I've tried to won't be able to deal with everything, you know, within the framework of four lectures. And since the original appeal had been to devise some lectures that would relate to Christian biography, I decided instead of just presenting four isolated cases of Christian biography, that I would, out of the four, do two detailed case studies. So that'll be tomorrow and the third one. And then one today that was kind of a broad overview, you see, of why these biographies are significant. They're not just isolated things. Now, I think in the process of presenting tomorrow's biography, there'll be considerable attention given to the way Lebret, who's a very remarkable pioneer, tried to introduce the goals of development as an explicit consideration that would determine your policy. So I'm hoping that perhaps the kinds of questions you would have in mind would find their kind of organic answer in that setting.
Well, let's take one more gentleman.